I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Reform Rabbi Miri Gold, who recently became the first non-Orthodox rabbi ever officially employed by the State of Israel as a rabbi. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last weekend, while vacationing in L.A., seeing my family, but not, of course, on vacation from Two Jewish, we are here for you every week, 52 weeks a year, as we have been for almost 10 years now, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year at our website, twojewishradio.com, and on iTunes. But I digress. Anyway, last weekend, I attended two very different Shabbat services in Los Angeles, the second biggest Jewish city in America, which makes it about the third largest Jewish city in the world on the basis of Jewish population, after only New York and Tel Aviv. Yes, I went to synagogue on vacation. I mean, what else should a rabbi do on Shabbat? One of the privileges of travel, not the burdens, is the opportunity to see how others celebrate Judaism, whether it's in Israel or Los Angeles or Turkey or England or wherever you happen to be visiting. And so, on Friday night in Los Angeles, my wife Wendy and I went to Stephen S. Wise Synagogue in Bel Air, a candidate for the largest Jewish congregation in the United States, and likely the world, made up of some 3,000 family units. On Saturday morning, I went to shul with my dad, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, at a very nice, smallish, Orthodox Chabad synagogue on Pico Boulevard called Beis Betzalel. There were some significant differences, of course, but interestingly, many similarities. First, the similarities. Both the Reform service on Friday night and the Orthodox one on Saturday morning were in lovely spaces, beautifully kept up and appropriate for prayer, and temperature controlled effectively. As you might expect from L.A. congregations, both shuls have significant show business ties. For example, the Chabad place, Beis Betzalel, is so lovely inside because Steven Spielberg's stepfather goes there, and Steven paid for the beautiful interior. Both were well-conducted services. The Reform Friday night service led by capable professionals, a rabbi, cantor, and four fine musicians, while the Orthodox Saturday morning service was led by both extremely capable volunteers, including a retired cantor, my dad at one point, and coordinated and sometimes led by a very capable rabbi. Both were thoughtfully constructed, used their own traditional liturgy and melodies well known to the two congregations. Lots of people sang along. In general, participation was pretty universal in both shuls, a machaya. Lots of good spirit and congregational song, and both services included intelligent, insightful commentary at the right point in the service. And both services flowed effortlessly, basically in Hebrew, with only page numbers given in English, but without interruption of long English responsive readings or rabbinic explanations or shtick. Both welcomed small children, even the disruptive kind. In both services, both Reform and Orthodox, a knowledgeable Jew with high expectations could enjoy the service without making any excuses. While I was only there for one Shabbat and didn't have a chance to attend Conservative, Reconstructionist, Renewal, and other Jewish religious services, I can report that the level of services at these two places was quite high, what I would honestly expect of a major Jewish city like Los Angeles. I can also say that our own services at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson match up quite well with either of these religious experiences, which was both reassuring, selfishly, and pleasant. And, of course, I'll try to steal a couple of their melodies. There were some differences, of course, and these are important, but also a couple of surprises. The first surprise is that while it was post-4th of July weekend and lots of people were out of town, in fact, L.A. traffic was the lightest I have seen in a long time, there were only about 100 people at services at Stephen S. Wise. Considering they have 3,000 families, this translates to a market share on Friday night, still in their main service, of perhaps 3% on a summer Shabbat. Not very impressive. We get about 100 people, and often more, on Friday night at my own Temple Emmanuel in Tucson in the summer, with about 700 families. That translates to something like a 15% market share. Maybe not overwhelming, but a whole lot better. In fact, the attendance on Saturday morning at the Chabad Shul, which has far fewer members, was about the same, about 100 people. A second surprise, neither sermon was particularly impressive or interesting, and the best Jewish insights came before the Orthodox service on Saturday morning, when a few of us attended a study session, a shiur, before services with Rabbi Lisman, who was exploring a Chabad text, but demonstrated a rich and deep Jewish knowledge matched to real human insight. Only five or six of us were there to hear it, but there were real pearls of wisdom there. Perhaps the best and most inspiring Jewish teaching always takes place in the smaller settings, or, of course, on 2 Jewish Radio. Some of the differences between the Orthodox and Reform services were obvious. The Orthodox service included no English readings at all, while there were some short English readings in the Reform synagogue. The Orthodox service was longer, with much more liturgy, as you'd expect, especially since Friday night in the Reform setting has much less to it than a Saturday morning service in an Orthodox one. And at Beis Bezalel, people sit at tables rather than in pews or rows of chairs, leading to a more relaxed feeling. Interestingly, if anything, the average age at the Orthodox shul was younger, with a good number of men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, as well as some small children. The Reform crowd was older on balance, with a few younger families sprinkled in. But the biggest difference, to be honest, was not the more Hasidic style of music in the Chabad place or the lovely musical instruments, two guitars, piano, and violin, played seamlessly in the Reform setting. It was the simple fact of gender. In the Orthodox shul, the small group of women was off to the side behind a serious machitza that hid them from view and hid the main service from their view. They essentially were not part of the same experience. The Reform service, in contrast, was led by a woman cantor with a fine voice and quality and included at least 50% women in the congregation. That difference never fails to amaze me. In the year 2012, it's actually pretty stark. A Reform movement that fully integrates and promotes women in every area of its religious experience, and an Orthodox world that simply does not. Both serve important purposes, and both serve Jews that care very deeply about their experience of a meaningful Jewish life. But that difference remains pretty stunning in up-to-the-minute Los Angeles, as everywhere else in the Jewish world. To play us in this morning, from a new CD by my old friend from Los Angeles, Bob Remstein, working with another old friend, cantor Mark Childs in Santa Barbara, California, here's some of Lecha Dodi, the song of welcome for Shabbat, composed by Bob Remstein and sung by the Shir Chadash Choir, which actually I started in 1986, back when I was a cantor in Santa Barbara, a really long time ago.
Zachor b'dibur echad Hishmianu el ha-meyuchad Adonai echad u'shmo echad L'shem u'letiferet v'lite hilah Shabbat lechu v'nelecha ki mekor ha-beracha merosh mikedem nesucha sof ma'ase b'macha shabbat echila
That That was a new Lechadodi, a song of welcome for Shabbat from Bob Remstein, with whom I went to UCLA, and cantor Mark Childs, who replaced me in Santa Barbara. When we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments, we'll meet our guest, Reform Rabbi Miri Gold. Her legal case in Israel was recently resolved, with her formally becoming employed by the State of Israel as a Reform Rabbi. Find out why that was on the front page of every Israeli paper and why it's a revolutionary change for the Jewish state when we meet Miri Gold in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Do you ever say to yourself, I just don't know what I feel like eating? You know you're hungry, but for what? Of course, I could try to tempt you with a Mama's Pizza. It's got mountains of fresh cheese, acres of sauce, and a crust that's so flavorful. Yes, a Mama's Pizza is always tempting, especially when you think about its aroma just as it's ready to come out of the oven. And what can you say about our toppings? How about meaty, crunchy, spicy, fresh, flavorful, delicious? There's no doubt when your mind is unsure about what your stomach is craving, hearing about a hot, fresh Mama's Pizza might just help you decide. But I'm out of time, so I guess I'll have to wait until later to give you the details about the delicious cheesiness and tantalizing nature of our hot, fresh pizza. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning very special guest, Rabbi Miri Gold. She is the Reform Rabbi at Kibbutz Gezer, who has been the subject of this extremely important court case that's 2005 that just came to a head while we were visiting Israel with her. Rabbi Gold, tell us a little bit briefly about the history of this court case that has now established that the government of Israel will now pay a salary to a Reform Rabbi for the first time in its history.
The court case began in 2005 when I petitioned the Supreme Court to be recognized as the rabbi of my community and to receive a salary, as do another 16 Orthodox rabbis serving the communities in our region.
So the decision went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided that they weren't going to decide, although they seemed favorable to you, and they asked for something to be worked out, and the Attorney General ultimately decided that this is the way it's going to go. Obviously, the Orthodox establishment was not in favor of this. Tell us a little bit about what this journey has meant for you.
When I agreed to be the petitioner, I had no idea if this case would ever be solved, because the Orthodox rabbinate has such a stronghold on all things officially Jewish. All funds from citizens' taxes go to support the Orthodox, and because there's no separation of church and state, there's never been a home for Reform or Conservative Judaism in Israel in any official capacity. So I think what I was especially concerned about was the state of democracy in Israel, because I believe that Israel is a democracy, it is a Jewish country, and how do we get those two things to live together in harmony?
And now there are another 16, is it, Reform rabbis who are sort of in track to end up in kind of the same situation where they're likely to be paid by the state as rabbis? Is that approximately right?
I was told that there are 15 positions to be divided between the Reform and the Conservative movements, only for people who are in a situation similar to mine, where they live in a regional council, meaning a community with no more than 5,000 people. Generally, we're talking about farming communities, although not exclusively. So we'll have to see who actually fits the bill.
Be interesting to see. We will talk much more with Rabbi Miri Gold when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there, twojewishradio.com, or from the Apple iTunes Store as podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, welcome back.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. You had an extended trip to Israel, and it turns out we were both in Tel Aviv the day of the Gay Pride Parade.
Yes, it was an amazing experience.
Not because we were, well, never mind. But, you know, it's like the third largest in the world. Tremendous experience. Boy, is that a symbol of kind of the new Israel or what?
You know, one thing that was amazing to me, you're going, for me it was the first time that I went and saw the gay parade.
You're from Haifa. Haifa's the sticks, kind of, compared to Tel Aviv, you know.
Haifa is the prettiest city.
It
well,
is.
Well, yeah. But basically, you know, it was by far more liberal event than I even anticipated. Some of the things there were more far than I would even imagine in my wildest imagination. Anyhow, you know, it was interesting. After the parade, there was an after party in the beach. It was huge, huge. I don't know how many people, but I would guess at least 30,000 people
were
there.
Oh, I think more. I saw it from the top of the Carlton Hotel, and it went from the ocean to the bars and the cafes. I mean, it covered the beach. It covered the water. Tremendous party.
Huge. And then it was Friday. And at 5 p.m., before sunset, suddenly the DJ said, "Okay, folks, Shabbat is entering. I hope you all have a great Shabbat. This is the end of this party. Go home, have your Shabbat dinner." And I was shocked, you know. That was like this combination of being, on one hand, the most liberal, open, wild party that one can imagine. And then, "Hey, folks, Shabbat is entering." And, you know, yeah, it's Jewish. It's Shabbat. It was shocking for me. It was great. You know, it was wonderful.
Kind of part of the very, I think, interesting, new, creative, and different Jewish culture that's evolved in Tel Aviv. You know, people talk about Tel Aviv as though it were a different entity. Like there's the world of Tel Aviv and then there's Israel. I don't know if that's true, but boy, that particular weekend, that particular Shabbat really highlighted that, didn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think people want to believe that Tel Aviv is different. But the truth is that
the Tel Aviv bubble they talk about.
Right, but the honest reality is that Tel Aviv basically is a reflection of the entire Israeli secular society. And in many cases, you know, there was an article that was published, I think, in the Haaretz a while ago by a guy that says, yeah, you're going to Tel Aviv when you're a student, you live there as long as you're a student, you party, and you're very liberal, and then when you get married and you want a family, you move to somewhere else where housing is a little more affordable. But basically, it's the same people and the same views. Obviously, when you're a student, you're more wild. You'll go to wild parties that will start at midnight and complete at 5 a.m. in the morning. And when you're married with kids, you might not do that. You know,
you have to get up at 5 in the morning. It's a different experience.
Yeah, you know, your kid come to you and wake you up because they want hot chocolate or something, right? So that's how it works when you're married with kids. But I believe your views and your identity stays the same and grows. I don't think that once you're getting married, you throw away your political perspectives, or you throw away your liberal perspectives, or your Jewish identity. I think it's the other way around. You actually build more layers around it and make it deeper, wider, more significant. And in a sense, I think Tel Aviv symbolizes those deepness and wideness and the beginning of it. It's like a seed. People come to Tel Aviv when they're studying at the University of Tel Aviv or just to party at Fridays and stuff. And when you look deep in Tel Aviv, you'll see all the layers. You'll see the party stuff, but you'll also see the you know, the place where Israel war was declared. You'll see all the beginning. You'll see Bialik's house, you know, where Israel songs were written and everything.
We will talk more about Israeli society today, next week. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about great Jewish museums around the world. Place I've never visited, the Jewish Museum of Berlin, you said is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you had to pick one of all the museums we're talking about, that would be the one. It's quite new. It is an architectural masterpiece, although it was controversial, designed by Libeskind after a worldwide contest for the design. It's also quite extensive. There's gardens, there's a cafe, there's whatever. And, you know, people go there and literally plan to spend the day. And I would say at least as many visitors to this museum are German non-Jews as are foreign tourists or Jews or both. It's a museum, first of all, of Jewish history, and an educational facility that teaches people about who Jews are, what they believe, where they come from, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not confined to the history of German Jewry or the history of Jews in Germany or anything like that, that's sort of narrow in focus. It's very broad in focus, but it's also very strong on the history of Jews in Germany, and it does not mince words about the Holocaust. It doesn't whitewash it at all. But it does focus on post-Holocaust German Jewish history, which is much richer and more complicated and more diverse than many people believe. I mean, I think a lot of people in this country believe that, you know, there's no Jews in Germany anymore. And there are not only Jews who have arrived from Israel or from the former Soviet Union, there are also Jews, German Jews, who somehow survived the war or who escaped and came back or who went to live in the Americas during the 30s and 40s and in the 50s or 60s, returned to Germany and particularly to Berlin. And the answer to that apparent conundrum lies in the fact that Berlin was always a very tolerant cosmopolitan city. Berlin always had room in its heart for extremists, so-called deviants or perverts or people from strange countries like Vietnam or Turkey or whatever. And now Berlin is one of the most cosmopolitan, tolerant, diverse places in Europe, and Jews feel very much at home there. There's a very lively Jewish communal life, ranging from, you know, far left, ultra reform, classic German reform Jewry to ultra right, you know, Chabad, Lubavitch, whatever, and everything in between. And there are women rabbis and women chazans and lots of functioning synagogues, kosher restaurants, whatever. But I would say the actual Berlin Jewish community, which evolved before this museum was opened, doesn't regard this museum as sort of its heart and soul. But in terms of the Jewish museums of Europe, I think this one is really head and shoulders above the rest. So if you have to visit only one, I'd probably pick that one. There are a couple others I think are worth talking about in Budapest and in Odessa, but maybe we'll do that next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tom. Berlin is the best Jewish museum to visit. Who would have thought?
Exactly.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Edna Feldman goes into the drugstore, walks up to Schwartz the pharmacist and says, "I would like to buy some cyanide." "Why in the world do you need cyanide?" asks the pharmacist. "To poison my husband." Schwartz shouts, "Are you out of your mind? That's against the law. I'd lose my license. They'd throw us both in jail. Forget it. No cyanide." Mrs. Feldman reaches into her purse and pulls out a photo of her husband in bed with the pharmacist's wife. "Oh, that's different," Schwartz says. "You didn't tell me you had a prescription." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values in very different ways. Let me explain. The setting for the final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land as the Israelites approach Canaan for a second time, after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. "We like the land we're traveling through now, here on the east bank of the Jordan, in what is today the country of Jordan, by the way, long before the Arabs moved into the Middle East. The leaders of Reuben and Gad say, let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." And Moses agrees, but in a very interesting language switch. First, he tells them, "Build towns for your children. Only then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is clear. Our families are to come first, our professions and incomes second. It's a human message and one that we need to relearn in every generation. Put family first. There's another great family message in our doubled portions this week, but this one has to do with what happens when things go badly wrong. In the very last section of Numbers, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created. The city of refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts were common, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. That meant that vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed someone intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed thought you had committed the killing, you were likely to be killed by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you were involved in a terrible situation like that, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge, the sort of blood feud that Mark Twain captured, describing the Hatfields and the McCoys several millennia later. Kind of clan murdering that takes place even today in the Palestinian Arab towns of the West Bank in Gaza. to preclude this social disaster. In the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge to be created in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of murder and revenge, the message was clear. The most basic unit of society must be nurtured, maintained, and protected, and its positive values strengthened always, even in the most trying situations. It's family that really matters. A great message for us today. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Miri Gold, the star of the most important religious case in Israel in years, will explain what it means to be a Reform rabbi in Israel and the pioneering first non-Orthodox rabbi to finally be employed by the State of Israel just in the last few weeks, when we return on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A deeply divided Presbyterian church last week became the latest American church to shy away from divesting in companies that supply equipment to Israel. It took a passionate debate that stretched late into the night and a vote that was nearly a tie. The decision not to divest, the culmination of an eight-year process which watched intently by Christians, Jews, and Palestinians in the U.S. and the Middle East. It's a relief to Jewish groups who have lobbied Presbyterians against divestment and the dismay of the movement known as BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, which advocates using economic leverage to pressure Israel to withdraw from the West Bank and hand it over to the Palestinians. By a vote of 333 to 331 with two abstentions, couldn't get much closer, the Presbyterian Church's General Assembly voted its biennial meeting in Pittsburgh to toss out the divestment measure and replace it with a resolution encouraging positive investment in the occupied territories. The results were so close that when posted in front of the convention, they evoked a collective gasp. After 2.5 hours of debate, the replacement resolution to invest in the territories passed more easily, 369 to 290. Presbyterians in favor of divestment said their church could not in good conscience hold stock in companies that they said perpetuate an unjust occupation and undermine the search for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Opponents said the divestment would unfairly vilify Israel and accomplish little but further polarization. Arthur Shippey, a delegate from southern New England, said what divestment will achieve is this. We will add a whisper soon lost in the storm, but we will further the divisions in our church. We have our own serious problems to address. We will precipitate divisions with the synagogues within our communities, whom we work with frequently on a variety of issues. This will be perceived as picking on Israel. And how could it not? The Presbyterian Church had been considering divestment in three companies, Caterpillar, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard, after 8 years of what the church says were fruitless negotiations to convince the companies to change their policies. A church committee report issued in 2011 said that Caterpillar supplies bulldozers used to demolish Palestinian homes, Motorola provides surveillance equipment to monitor Palestinian villages in the West Bank, and Hewlett-Packard supplies biometric scanners used at checkpoints and technology used by the Israeli Navy in the blockade of Gaza. The General Assembly is the most senior decision-making body for the Presbyterian Church, which has about 2 million members. The Presbyterian Convention drew Jewish organizers to Pittsburgh to lobby for and against divestment, mostly against. Some were from Jewish Voice for Peace, which supports divestment, but most Jewish groups lobbied to defeat the divestment resolution. Even relatively liberal groups like J Street and Americans for Peace Now, which are critical of settlement expansion in the territories. Mainline Protestant churches in the U.S. have long maintained ties to Palestinian churches in the occupied territories, supporting missions, hospitals, churches, and charitable groups there. When Protestant church groups travel to Israel on tours and pilgrimages, many visit the territories and meet with Palestinians who share frustrations and travails. The United Methodist Church voted against divestment at its meeting in Tampa in May. The nation's largest Lutheran denomination, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, rejected divestment measures twice in 2007 and 2011. However, the Quakers, the Friends Fiduciary Committee, which handles investments for about 250 Quaker meetings and organizations, did decide to divest from Caterpillar this year. In other news, German ambassador to Israel, Andreas Michaelis, told a Knesset committee last week that Berlin will introduce legislation allowing circumcision to be practiced in the country universally. Speaking before the Knesset Immigration, Absorption, and Diaspora Affairs Committee, Michaelis said a law will be introduced overturning a recent court ruling that banned circumcision in Cologne because it violates the child's rights. Jewish life in Germany in the wake of the awful past events is entirely different, said Michaelis. Obviously, the ban on circumcision is more sensitive in Germany than other places because of the Holocaust, but it's important to stress the Jewish community in Germany is growing. The Conference of European Rabbis will hold an emergency meeting in Berlin this week to discuss ways of repealing the ban. The ruling in Cologne is perhaps one of the gravest attacks on Jewish life in Europe in the post-Holocaust world, said Pinchas Goldschmidt, president of the Conference of European Rabbis. The court failed to consider how fundamental Brit Milah is to the Jewish faith and identity as the original and eternal symbol of commitment to God. And presumed Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney. What a presumption. Will host a fundraising event in Jerusalem at $60,000 per plate on July 29th. Delegates will fly in from the U.S. for the event, which a Republican source said would be a small meeting, but a big fundraiser. Immediately after the fundraising meeting, Romney will host a conference in Jerusalem where he will lay out his Middle East policy. Romney will stay in Jerusalem for a couple of days, during which he will meet with President Shimon Peres, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, opposition leader Shelly Yachimovich of Labor, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Apparently these days, the road to the November American presidential election runs straight through Jerusalem? As goes Jerusalem, so goes America? I don't know. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Mary Gold. She's the rabbi of Kibbutz Gezer, recently was accepted as an official paid employee of the State of Israel, in that first Reform rabbi ever to be compensated directly by the state as a Reform rabbi, serving as a Reform rabbi in Israel. This case kind of may open the floodgates. The floodgates may not open as quickly as people think, perhaps. The progress reform movement in Israel has been a gradual one. Can you explain a little bit about that? Not all of our listeners are familiar with it.
I would say that most Israelis are not at all familiar with liberal Judaism. Most people who live in Israel have come from Europe, from North Africa, from other places where there aren't any progressive communities, which is interesting considering that there are close to 2 million Jews around the world who affiliate with progressive communities, the Reform movement being the largest of them. So I think that one of the things happening is that Israelis are starting to realize that on the ground there is more than one way to be Jewish, and that there's a place for people to find their home in our Reform communities in Israel.
There's been a progress in at least the public opinion surveys about the Reform movement, which, you know, when I started coming to Israel long ago, I'm getting old now, people didn't have any idea what Reform meant. Now there's a growing consciousness of it. Tell us a little bit about how that's evolving.
Well, actually, I think to some extent it's because Israelis go abroad to study and to work, particularly young people after the army who work in Reform and conservative movement camps, people who go to the university or work in big companies on the one hand, and even though the percentage of Reform Jews who come to Israel is still relatively small, it is a growing number. And I believe that any time a group comes from Israel and tells people they meet that they're from a Reform group, that it opens up the minds of those who might have thought that we're something other than Jewish, that we're some marginal, cultish kind of a group. And a small anecdote would be that when my husband went to buy flowers 1 year before Rosh Hashanah, the woman who knows him well said, "Oh, is this your holiday as well?" She really didn't know. Or someone who came to a bar mitzvah saw a Torah scroll and said, "Oh, this can't be a Reform congregation. There's a Torah scroll here." So there's a lot of ignorance that we are slowly but surely overcoming.
Ignorance is not hostility. The response of the Orthodox establishment, of course, is a lot closer to hostility. How is a complicated question, but how is it that this particular case kind of went around the Rabbanut, the Orthodox establishment, and the Ministry of Religious Affairs? Because it seems to me that they would never have acceded to this kind of an agreement.
And they still haven't. Again, remembering that we have separation of church and state nowhere in this country, meaning that the rabbinate has a stronghold on anything having to do with life cycle events, with institutions, etc.
With personal identity, personal religious identity, anything.
Right. In fact, there are many people who would say, "I'm secular, but the synagogue I don't go to is Orthodox." Their right. mindset is Orthodox with a small o, perhaps. We petitioned the Supreme Court of the State of Israel. We did not go to the rabbinate at all. And so the case was settled when the Ministry of Culture agreed to be the conduit to release funds that they were willing to give to cultural community leaders. And the beauty of the case is that they're now willing to say that it's going to rabbis of non-Orthodox communities. That was a lot of the struggle in the case. They didn't want to use the word rabbi, knowing that it's very upsetting to the Orthodox establishment.
I was with a group of rabbis about a year ago that met at the foreign ministry with a variety of different people, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox rabbis. One of the people we met with is a guy named Rotem, who's a member of Knesset, who said, "Well, why do they have to be called rabbis? You know, they're working, they're getting paid as sports recreational authorities. What's the difference to get a salary from the state?" Does make a difference, doesn't it?
And this Rotem is the one who has come up with a bill to make it much more extreme for someone who wants to convert to Judaism, to really put all the power in the hands of the chief rabbinate. And really, thanks to American Jewish leaders who literally flew to Israel at a moment's notice, was that bill put aside, at least shelved for now.
Do you think that your case, which is now, you know, kind of a pioneering case, I compared it in an email I sent to my congregation to Rosa Parks, you know, I mean, this is really sort of earthquake kinds of news. How do you think this is going to affect those people who might be interested in the Reform movement? There's been a lot of publicity. What do you see as the impact?
Well, I liken this case to another woman named Alice Miller, who was a commercial pilot as a teenager somehow, and she wanted to become an Air Force pilot, and the Air Force said, no way, we don't take women. She went to the Supreme Court, she won her case, she was able to try out. But like most young people who try out to become pilots, most of them don't make it. She didn't make it. But today there are women fighter pilots and navigators. So she helped move this along. There are women in other combat units as well. And so I'm hoping that this case will simply move us forward to more recognition of the importance of religious pluralism in this country. And I wasn't sure that I'd ever see the results of it in my lifetime. And it wasn't because I was despairing to that extent, but just knowing it takes time for change to happen.
You came to Israel in 1977, I think. You have seen the reform movement. You were self-ordained much later, but you've seen the reform movement in a variety of situations. In the last few years, it's gone from 25 congregations or communities to 40 congregations. Is this the most exciting time you've seen? It's an obvious question. And what do you see next?
Well, actually, the timing of the case came a few days before the biennial in Israel of the Reform Movement, so there was a tremendous amount of excitement. Obviously, there are those who are a little bit more sober in their thinking who realize that we haven't won everything, but certainly it's a step in the right direction. When I went to rabbinic school, we affiliated our little congregation with the Reform Movement as a regional congregation so that people who are looking for this alternative could find it. And so we take in a huge geographical area because there still aren't nearly enough congregations to serve all those people.
Why would a Chiloni Israeli, secular Israeli, who, yeah, they're off on Shabbat because that's the day off. Yeah, they fast on Yom Kippur because that's what Jews do. Yes, they have something on Pesach. I wouldn't call it exactly a Seder, but they get together. Why would they suddenly decide they want to be part of a Reform community? You can be Jewish in Israel, you don't need a synagogue, you know, the synagogue don't close to Orthodox. Why would they suddenly decide to connect with the Reform congregation?
I don't think anyone would suddenly decide, to be honest. I think, as in many places, people come from different angles. It could be that when we talk about 15,000 people walking the streets of Tel Aviv the evening of Shavuot for what they call Tikkun Leil Shavuot, this has become a happening. So some people come in through the intellectual angle. They want to learn. They're interested. They understand that everyone has the right to approach the Jewish bookshelf. You don't have to be a learned yeshiva bacher to do that. It could be because their kid was bar mitzvah age and they said, you know what, we want to do something that's meaningful. And the Reform synagogue fits the bill. So from many angles, people become involved. And last night, I was interviewed by someone who said, I'm a Reform Jew and I didn't know it. Because it's something that people learn about and then say, this fits my world outlook.
There have been Reform Movement successes in Israel, Beit Daniel, which has 3, 4, 5 bar bat mitzvahs every Shabbat. That's a kind of a success we see in the suburban parts of the United States, and then we worry because we're not really sure we're creating Jewish life, we're just kind of matching, hatching, and dispatching people. Is there a possibility of that happening in Israel as well?
I don't think so. In fact, Gilad Kariv, who is the head of the Reform Movement in Israel, has always said when people come into a synagogue for whatever reason, whether it's a study group or it's to be a guest at a bar mitzvah, they take something with them. And if the little they take is that they're more favorably disposed to Reform Judaism, that's a good thing. And every time there's a bar mitzvah, whether there are 50 people there or 200 people there, it's more foot soldiers, even those who wouldn't necessarily say, I signed up to do this, but who are favorably disposed and who are even sometimes surprised at how much they enjoyed it. And I'd say one of the best things for me is when people come up to me after a bar mitzvah and say, this was just so meaningful. I knew what was going on. And we're talking about Israelis who read and understand Hebrew.
Right. You know, it's funny, I did a bar mitzvah at Robinson's Arch on this trip to Israel, and there was an Israeli family, secular chilonim, from Haifa, who had come down, and they came up to me after. They said, exactly that. This is the most meaningful sermon I've ever been to. I didn't know that it could be like this. There was so much Hebrew. Now, this is an American version, not the Israeli version. So having had a little bit of that experience, it's very gratifying, isn't it?
It is. Something that's important in our congregation, Birkat Shalom, is that we created a Friday night Sidur for Kabbalat Shabbat that's in Hebrew and English, because we always want our American guests to feel comfortable. And sometimes it's interesting to see reactions when people go to a Reform congregation in Israel and everything's in Hebrew. They're a little bit surprised about that. So in whatever ways we can help people feel comfortable, same thing with weddings. Instead of mumble jumble, the woman has a voice. The couple comes under the wedding canopy together to symbolize their mutual home. This also affects people in a positive way to say, I understood, it was meaningful. And that's what might bring them back or cause them to call on us when they have some religious needs. You have concentric circles. You have the hardcore who do come, and then you have others who come and go. And we hope that the small core will grow.
So, I guess probably a romantic kind of question, but when you came to Israel as a kind of a chalutz, a pioneer to move to kibbutz, did you think this was the kind of chalutz you were going to be?
I had no idea. I thought it was just going to be easy to be Jewish, and I soon learned otherwise. But as I look back on it, it's been a very interesting process. I don't think at the time I ever thought I'd be a rabbi, but it grew out of the circumstances. Say, here's a community, and a community deserves some leadership, and so I volunteered for that role.
Thank you, Mary, for a great visit, and may you continue to volunteer for that role and continue to see success in your congregation and within the Reform Movement.
Thank you very much.
Shabbat Shalom. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll get a final musical play out and hear about next week's guest.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, to find balance in life is to find happiness. Now, I assume he was a smart guy being a philosopher and all, so it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this, what one Mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese? Heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce? Crispy crust or lightly done crust? It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Rabbi Gilad Kariv, the Executive Director of the Israel Movement for Progressive Judaism. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Bob Remstein's new CD, Messengers of Peace. It's his Vishamru, a song for Shabbat. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shamaru v'nei Yisrael et
ha-shabbat, la-sot et ha-shabbat, le-dorot ha-merit olam. Bye.